I'm much more used to preaching on someone very much more important than any of the Puritans. But the footsteps of Christ in this world are people, and the Puritan age is full of his presence. And we can turn this time by his grace into a time of adoration and worship, not merely a time of information and assimilation. I've been asked to speak on the English Puritans, and difficult as it is to say a little on so much, I'm very happy to do so for several reasons. You see, this is undoubtedly the most exciting period historically. Historically, it's probably the most exciting period in all of English history. That period, roughly from, let's say, the 1550s and 60s to the 1660s. That 100 years or so contains virtually the birth of modern England and is the cradle of our democracy and our freedoms. But as well as being a most exciting period historically, it is the most profound period spiritually. A period when the power of the Reformation really made itself known in our land. A period which marked the birth of nonconformity to which you and I belong. And a period especially in which there was so much of revival and the outpouring of the Spirit of the risen Christ on the English people and indeed on the people of the British Islands as a whole. And again, I'm very happy to speak on the Puritans because here the most salutary lessons for evangelicals today are to be found. If evangelicals ought to be learning off anybody in human history today, it is, since the days of the apostles, the Puritans who should be our teachers and our instructors. If evangelical needs anything in this rather anemic age of ours, it's a good dose of iron from the Puritans. Now, it's difficult to know where to start when you're talking about Puritanism because the pedigree of ideas is endless. But I'm not talking tonight to professionals or historians or even fellow ministers, and if you've never read any history to speak of, then this is your lecture tonight. You know that under God, the young German monk Martin Luther spearheaded the great and glorious Reformation. And the world was never going to be the same again after Martin and after that great outbreak of truth. The darkness of centuries of medieval superstition was rolled back, and the bright light of a New Testament morning shone again on the people of Europe. Martin Luther spearheaded that great movement. But after Martin, there came a younger contemporary of his, John Calvin. And if Martin Luther was the great pioneer of the Reformation, then Calvin was to a degree its perfecter. Calvin had this great mind which organized the truths that were being learned and developed them. He was the great systematizer of Protestant truth. And he deepened and matured the whole movement, which indeed would never have been the strong movement it was had it not been for God's work through him. And yet all this, those exciting years of Luther and Calvin, all this took place, as you know, on the continent, largely in Germany and Switzerland. And so you ask, well, what about England in those days, in the 1520s and 30s and 40s? And the truth is, not to put too fine a point on it, that England was a mess spiritually in the earliest days of the Protestant Reformation. You see, the English are not really idealists. They are pragmatists. What works is probably right. And so England had a very different adventure than the continental peoples. And yet the Reformation had begun to affect various scholars and clergymen here in England too. They were reading the books that were produced by the continental theologians, and in their travels they were meeting some of them. One of them married the daughter of a lesser known but great reformer, Osiander. And so in England there were certain clergymen who were to be high placed in the English churches, people like John Hooper and Nicholas Ridley and Hugh Latimer and, of course, Thomas Cranmer, who began to change under the influence of these teachings. They were Protestantized and evangelicalized by them. And yet the situation for years was terribly confused and mixed. You had these people like Latimer and Ridley and Hooper and Cranmer, who really were Protestants. They were evangelicals. They had discovered the liberty of the gospel. And yet, because of their times and because of their own early development, an early stage of development, they still had a tremendous amount of the old Catholic trappings about their faith. And they were imperfectly Protestantized and reformed, if you like. And then there was the time when Henry VIII, the King of England, as you know, overthrew the papal supremacy. He didn't become a Protestant, he was a Catholic. And his quarrel wasn't with theology, with the theology of Catholicism, it was with the Pope. It was political and it was personal in connection with his divorce. You know all about that, no doubt. But Henry VIII overthrew the papal supremacy in England for his own headship of the church in England. That church was still Catholic, but by this time, people like Cranmer and the others I'd mentioned were really Protestants. And so there was this difficult situation in which they were trying to effect reforms and develop along the right lines, while Henry remained the despot and the carnal man that he was. And then Henry VIII died. And his young son, Edward, came to the throne. He was Edward VI. And he was only a boy of 10 years old when he came to the throne in 1547. Now, Edward only reigned for 6 years. He was a sickly youth, and he didn't live very long. But those 6 years were very important years for us, because Edward was a Protestant. He was a sincere and convinced Protestant, young as he was. And under him and Archbishop Cranmer, Protestantism flourished and became, if you like, the official religion of the Christians in the land and of the church in England. And they developed that Protestantism. There was the first prayer book of Edward's reign, then there was a second prayer book which was more obviously and thoroughgoingly Protestant, and so forth. But those bright years, just about 6 in number, came to an end with his tragic death. He died at 16. And his sister, Henry VIII's daughter — Henry had a son, 2 daughters. His son died, then his daughter Mary came to the throne. Now Mary was a Catholic, a thoroughly convinced Catholic, the daughter of Mary's first wife. She had spent a very unhappy childhood. She was a sad and she was a bitter woman. She came to the throne in 1553, determining that if she did anything, she would restore England to the old faith and to true subservience to the Holy Father at Rome. She married a Catholic, and in 3 of her 5 years' reign — she only reigned for 5 years, but in 3 of those 5 years, no less than 300 people were burned alive at the stake for their Protestantism. They were the mob. They were the martyrs. About a third of them were clergymen, but, you know, a fifth of them were women, who have always featured very prominently in any Reformation or in any revival, if you look closely enough. And a fifth of the martyrs of Mary's reign were women. She was a sad and bitter ideologue, and she is called in history Bloody Mary. Mary Tudor, Mary I. Now, it is here that our story properly begins, and that we begin to see the birth of Puritanism. Because many hundreds of refugees fled from Mary's persecution, and they went abroad. Many hundreds of them. They were merchants, and they were students, and they were clergymen, and they were young men studying for holy orders. And they fled her persecution and went to the continent where Protestants were safe, Switzerland and Germany. And here, especially in Switzerland, they saw a fully developed Protestantism, the like of which still hadn't been seen in England here, where everything was slower and people were muddling along. They especially saw the glories of Protestantism and evangelicalism in Geneva, the Geneva of John Calvin, a city which had been utterly transformed from a vile and a carnal past to a remarkable present, the Geneva of John Calvin, which John Knox, who visited it, lived there for a while, described as the most perfect school of the apostles since the time of Christ. There were over 6,000 exiles from different countries, swelling the population of Geneva. Normally, the population of that city was only about 13,000. But now it was swelled to nearly 20,000, with these people that were coming, not just from England, but from Catholic France, where at one time up to 500 were being burned alive every week, and from other countries too. And Geneva was a haven and a refuge for them all, the Geneva of John Calvin. John Knox was there. If you're a bit surprised because he's a Scotsman, the reason had been that he'd been ministering in England. He'd ministered in Scotland, then he'd been exiled, he'd had a time as a galley slave, you can read it all in a good life of John Knox. Then he went up to Berwick and ministered in safety there, near to his homeland, but in a country where he was free to do so. And then he fled to the continent with all the others. That's why he's around. And John Calvin's Geneva became not only a refuge and a haven for these Protestant refugees, but it became the heart of Protestant learning and education, where there was a theological university. Theological training was given by Calvin and others to the very many who studied there, and it was the heart of missions to Europe also, and it was the center of a great movement from which others were encouraged far away. The discipline or the government of the church there was Presbyterian, as we would know it now. And that was, of course, a thoroughly developed form of Protestantism. They also exercised church discipline and so strove to keep those living in gross worldliness and open sin and those who had no real evangelical experience from taking the Lord's Supper and being regarded as members of the church. Now, that was Geneva. No popish garments, except that the ministers wore the old Genevan gown of the scholars. No liturgy, except their own form of worship. And here, among other things, the famous Geneva Bible was translated for the English people by William Whittington and John Knox and others who were preparing for better days. But it wasn't only happening in Geneva. Those refugees that fled from Mary the First in England went to other cities too, like Strasbourg and Frankfurt on Main and other places. And they gathered in little enclaves, these English people. And remember, they'd all fled for religious reasons. They were very devout people. And so wherever they gathered, these refugees in their little enclaves, they wanted immediately to establish worship and church life. And some very interesting things began to happen at this point, because they were now free from all restrictions. And not only that, but they had the pattern of a truly liberalized Protestantism, liberated, I should say, in Geneva. An interesting experiment started to take place. At Frankfurt, for instance, William Whittington and others formed what you and I would call practically a congregational church, at any rate, an independent evangelical church. They had a church which was composed of sincere believers, devout men and women, visible saints and their seed, of course, and they established a church with its own elders, its own pastors, and freedom from the prayer book of England and the English liturgy.
And this was a fascinating experiment. John Knox was called to be one of the pastors of this church. And for a while it bid fair to becoming a sort of model of what could happen all over the place. Except that a man called Richard Cox, who was also one of the refugees from Mary, came in and spoiled it all. He came over from Strasbourg, and he was a dyed-in-the-wool Anglican, as we would say. And he was horrified at these experiments. He said, "You can't do that sort of thing here." He said, "We're English. We have an English church. And this company has got to have the face of an English church. You've got to come back to the liturgy and the prayer book and the standards that we knew under Edward VI when we were free Protestants, but when we were English Protestants. You can't just follow these Genevans and others and do anything you like." And there was that great struggle between John Knox and Richard Cox, in which you have sort of in miniature the whole struggle of Puritanism and Anglicanism with their different attitudes. John Knox eventually being a surprisingly moderate and peaceable man. Nobody ever thinks that of John Knox, but he was. He left and went back to Geneva. But it was the beginning of something big. However, you remember that Mary died after just those few years of her reign. And her sister came to the throne in England. Henry VIII's other daughter, Elizabeth. Elizabeth I, a Protestant queen. And all these exiles flocked back to England at Mary's death and Elizabeth's succession in the year 1558. They were full of jubilation, full of vision and zeal to continue the Reformation in England and to complete it and to see revival and freedom and evangelicalism take its full course. But Elizabeth I had other ideas. She was a very strong-minded woman. She was a politician, not a theologian. She didn't care too much for the niceties of theology, and she always leaned towards her father's religion if the truth were known. She was really more Catholic than Protestant. One thing she did agree with her father on, that the Pope wasn't going to be the head of her realm either. Henry had made himself the head of the church, she made herself the supreme governor of the church. She wanted control, and it was far easier to have control in an Anglican system than ever it would have been in a system of Presbyterian churches, or even, heaven forfend, of independent evangelical churches. And so she settled with her bishops for what has become known as the Media Via, the famous Elizabethan middle way, which was a middle way in between Roman Catholicism at one extreme and Genevan Protestantism at another extreme. And that middle way is what we have always called Anglicanism. It's a middle-of-the-road way between Catholicism and this sort of Presbyterianism or even independency. This was her Media Via. First of all, she asserted her governorship of the church with the famous Act of Supremacy, and then she introduced within a year her Act of Uniformity in 1559. Determining that there would be one uniform religion in the land, and Catholics and Puritans alike would come into it and would be disciplined and would take their place in it. She re-established the prayer book of Edward's day, except that she made it a little bit more Catholic than it had been then, and she enforced its liturgy and its rubrics. The rubrics are the directions that are printed in red in the prayer book, telling priests and people what they should do and how they should do it as they went through the liturgy. And so you had all the paraphernalia of the old prayer book system. For instance, the ministers were to make the sign of the cross at baptism, something the Puritans would never do because of its association with superstition and with Catholicism. They had to kneel when they received the sacrament of the Lord's Supper, the rails. Again, something that the Puritans would never do, because it harked back to the Catholic days when the priest elevated the bread or the wine, the host, it magically transformed into the true, essentially the true, body and blood of our Lord. And so to kneel to take the sacraments was doing precisely the thing that had been done for hundreds of years in England, right up until then, where people worshipped the body and blood of our Lord Jesus Christ, transubstantiation. So they wouldn't kneel at the supper. They had conscientious objections to this. Then there were the words at the burial service, burying all and sundry in sure and certain hope of the resurrection and a life eternal. And again, that was an insult to the Puritan conscience, to their doctrine of the new birth, and to the thoroughgoingness of their teaching that the church was truly a place for saints, not just for all and sundry, and they couldn't bury sinners as though they were saints. Then she introduced, of course, the system introduced vestments again, which again the Puritans hated because they were the relics of popery and separating the priests from the people, so forth. There was the vestarian controversy with the Puritans. There were the ornaments. And last but not least, there was the whole system of episcopacy, ruled by the bishops, the prelates, prelacy as it was called. Many of those bishops living lordly lives, great power, great wealth, aristocrats, princes among the people, far removed from them, and having the sort of power that the New Testament knew nothing about. Because in the New Testament, the term bishop or episcopos simply refers to an overseer in the local church. And therefore, the minister in any church was a bishop. But here, these Elizabethan bishops were not even general superintendents. They were men with great power and great wealth. Now, here you had, therefore, right at the beginning of Elizabeth's reign, these two camps, the Anglican and the Puritan camp. The Anglicans through the Queen, or the Queen through her bishops, trying to make the Puritans conform to the English model of Protestantism, the Anglican Church. But at the same time, there wasn't really a once-for-all Anglicanism at that point. You mustn't think of the Puritans as being nuisances in the English church, a little minority of people who weren't prepared to accept what was there and work within the system. No, it wasn't like that. The English church was still fluid. It was in the process of becoming. It was developing. Everything had been in the melting pot. The Puritans had as much right to say where the English churches should go as the Anglicans. John Knox had as much right as old Richard Cox. And so you can understand that here at the beginning, the Puritans were determined that they were going to reform the system, change the system, and thoroughly Protestantize the English churches. They weren't going to be a ginger group in the Anglican setup. They were going to make the English church what it should be, a true Protestant evangelical church. Now, you had clearly, right at the beginning, two camps with two very different ways of thinking and acting. Mark this well. It wasn't just a quarrel over different clothes that ministers should wear. It wasn't just talking about a few ceremonies and a few symbols. It went much, much deeper than that. That is ludicrously inadequate to explain the division between Anglican and Puritan. What you really had was two different types of mentality, and indeed, two different types of doctrine. Take, for instance, the doctrine of man. Basically, the Anglican position about man was that man is not so fallen that he can't rely on his own reason in spiritual things as well as in everyday things. The Anglicans said, no, it's all right. I know these things aren't in the Bible. You haven't got this sort of bishops. You haven't got this sort of vestments and ceremonies and liturgy and all that. But, you know, godly people, they have reason. And reason is their supreme in life. And they can produce these things if it seems good to them. And their reason is to be relied upon in things spiritual as well as in things worldly. Whereas the Puritans said something very different. They said, look here, man is a fallen creature, and he's more fallen in spiritual things than in anything else.
His reason might be reasonably unimpaired when it comes to worldly things, buying and selling and building houses and goodness knows what. But when it comes to spiritual things, he is not at all to be trusted. He is a fallen creature. They said, like Calvin, that because of the fall, while intelligence was continued, yet general intelligence, that is, when it came to matters about God and salvation, men were blinder than moles, and so they insisted that these things shouldn't be added, that the church should go back to the New Testament model, distrusting its own inventions for all their rationale. So there was a difference, you see, in the doctrine of man and the fall. Then there was a difference in the doctrine of the church, too. Anglicanism stressed from the beginning, and this was finally formulated by the famous Richard Hooker, Laws of Ecclesiastical Polity, which finally, as it were, solidified, defined Anglicanism once and for all. Anglicanism stressed the territorial nature of the church. Now, this is very important. It said, when you've got a Christian prince like Elizabeth, though she was a woman, they refer to her as the Christian prince, and you've got a Christian parliament, and you've got a Christian system like ours, you've got a Christian country. The state and the church have become coextensive. And so if you're a member of the state, the Christian country, you are a member of the church. And so all the children must be baptized, and everybody must be regarded as a member of the visible church. In order to explain themselves, they tended to stress, of course, the difference between the visible and the invisible church. They said, we know everybody isn't converted, but you can be members of the visible church without being members of the invisible one, the true one, the spiritual one, the saved one. And they took this from the Old Testament, of course, where you had Israel as God's nation, when the church was the nation and the nation was the church, and where you had a spiritual people within it, a remnant, a church within the church, an invisible church within the visible church almost. But they completely ignored the fact, or refused to accept the fact, that the New Testament had changed all that, and you didn't get that sort of thing anymore. It had become more personalized now. It had become a matter of people out of every nation forming local churches, not nations being elect anymore as nations. And so the Anglicans stressed the territorial nature of the church and the visible and invisible dichotomy. But the Puritans, on the other hand, developed more and more a dislike for this visible-invisible business. At the beginning, and you must remember that at the beginning everything was developing, everything was in the process of maturing, consolidating. And the Puritans also tended to think in terms of a state church, for instance. They all thought that. Luther as well, and Calvin and all the others tended to accept the close relation of church and state in those days. But Puritanism developed more and more a dislike for this dichotomy between the visible and the invisible. And it moved towards the idea of the church as a society of saints. Committed people, dedicated people, with a personal evangelical experience and a life submitted to the rule of Christ. And, of course, they included their seed, their children, because they weren't Baptists. These things take time. And then there was also, just to mention it, the difference between Anglican and Puritans in the matter of church government and liturgy. The Anglicans said that the church may develop her own government methods with bishops, priests, and deacons, and chapters, and all the rest of it, and that the church can develop her own liturgical order. The Puritans said, no, the church must go back to the New Testament for it all. It's a melting pot situation. Well, let's throw everything into the melting pot and go right back to Paul and Peter and John and the churches of Ephesus and Galatia and so forth. The church must go back to the New Testament for its warrant in the way it worships, in the way it governs itself, in the way it runs itself, basically. And so there was this great controversy between them. This two different attitudes. It isn't just a matter of a few rogues and books and liturgy. Different mentalities, do you see? Different attitudes altogether. And for the next 90 years of the Elizabeth's, the Elizabethan Mediaweir, the Middle Way, ruled in England, right up until the time of the Civil Wars and Cromwell. At first, the Puritans tried in political ways to reform the church in Elizabeth's day, in the early stages, through Parliament, where there was always a strong body of Puritan politicians, because Puritans aren't just the clergymen, you understand, they are the people as well, and there were politicians who were Puritans in Parliament, there were plenty of them, and they made themselves known, they were called the Puritan Chorus. And they tried to reform the church from the top downwards in Parliament and in Convocation, where you had Puritan bishops and Anglican bishops struggling, as it were, there. And they tried to reform the church from the top down. But Elizabeth was too clever for them by far. At the same time, it's good for us to remember this early, that the Puritans weren't a minority group. They were, in fact, a majority group in one respect. I explain that. 75% of the people of England didn't care a hoot what religion the land belonged to. They didn't care whether they were Catholic or Protestant, whether they were Anglican or Puritan. Only about 25% of the people had real convictions. But of that 25%, by far the majority were puritanically inclined and wanted to go back to the simplicities of the faith. And with that intuition that I think one finds in the evangelical mind before the theologians spoil it, people could see, I think, that this was the way forward. This was the New Testament way, the simplicities of faith and worship. But at this time you had Elizabeth and her bishops having all the power, so that Anglicanism had the muscle, though Puritanism had the support and the people. And so the Puritans started to try to reform in Parliament and Convocation. You had the growth of the Presbyterian movement with John Field and others. But failing time and time again because of Elizabeth's superior power and politics. Then, as you know, they turned to their famous grassroots reformation, which is a sort of spiritual hidden revolution. They became an underground movement, with their own presses, their own pamphlets, their own understanding, and to a degree their own organization. They found that they couldn't reform the land from the top down, so they sought to reform it from the bottom up. There were great efforts to spread Puritan preaching. Preaching was always the strength of Puritanism. The Anglicans were more concerned with liturgy in one thing and another, but the Puritans were men of preaching. And they were great preachers, and crowds came to hear them, and crowds went away fired with the vision and the power, not only of Puritanism, but of its Lord and his kingdom. And they developed things like the famous Puritan prophesyings, where in a market town you'd have many ministers coming together, and people who weren't ministers, during the week, and one of them would stand up and preach on a text, and then another one would stand up and fill in what he felt the first had left out, and others would start to discuss it, and people would ask questions, and it was that sort of seminar, come preaching service, come discussion. And it was a tremendous way in which to educate the clergy, many of whom, to tell the truth, needed it in those very earliest days. And so many were influenced by them, and many of the people too. And then there were the famous Puritan lectureships, where in market towns and in other places, men who weren't the beneficed clergy of that particular church were paid for by a consortium or group of merchants or several churches or whatever, and they would supply a fund. And setting up a fund, they'd have a lecturer, a Puritan lecturer,
And he would preach once on Sundays and perhaps once on Wednesdays, and some of the great Puritan folios and quartos have on the title page, so-and-so lecturer at such and such a town. And by all these means, they sought to spread the gospel and the Puritan way of looking at things. With their local refusals to wear the surplice or use the prayer book. And there were great men at this time. One of the troubles about this lecture is that I've got to try to give you a hundred years in this short time. And I can't find it easy to get in the colour, the personalities of the period, the human warmth, and the whole romance of Puritanism. But to give you a few names, there were people like Richard Greenham, for instance, of Dry Drayton, which is near Cambridge, a tremendously godly man, and one of the early greats of Puritanism. Typical of Puritans, he was a laborious and painful preacher, as they used to call them. He rose at 4 a.m. in the morning and preached at dawn every day, except at Saturdays. He was a tremendously vigorous preacher, and used to finish his sermons dripping with preparation, with perspiration. That will go down as one of the quotable quotes of this series, won't it? And if anybody was asleep, they'll be wondering what they've missed. Dripping with perspiration. He gave away most of his money to the poor, was a great help to afflicted consciences, on which he published as well as preached, was very influential with the Cambridge students who used to come out to Dry Drayton from Cambridge. Strangely enough, he had a very poor response from his local, rural population. That didn't often happen. They often took very well with the common people because they were the people's preachers. It was often the more courtly divines and the bishops who spoke in such la-di-da Latinized sentences and word plays that nobody could understand them. But the Puritans were thoroughly down-to-earth, dramatic, exciting, emotional preachers who used every means to communicate to the people in the language of the day. Surprising, you know, that some of the Puritan lovers of today are in their method totally contradicting the Puritans. Because the Puritans were very up-to-date, very daring. They were innovators as far as preaching was concerned. But Richard Greenham had a very poor response from the locals, and most of his influence was with the Cambridge students. It used to be a saying that he had pastures green, but sheep full lean. But then there were others, like Richard Rogers in Essex, in Wethersfield, who organized congregational prayer meetings, who wrote a famous folio called Seven Treatises on the Christian Life, which was an archetypal Puritan book which talked not only about the importance of morning and evening prayer and secret prayer and family prayer, but showed how Puritanism was to be lived out at every level of a man's conscious life. From the time he got out of bed in the morning and started to dress, reminding himself that he could clothe his soul in the righteousness of Christ, to the time he went to bed and took off his clothes and reminded himself that he must put off this mortal body also. It showed how different the Puritan was in his family, to his wife, to his servants, and in his place of business. Richard Rogers, besides being a clergyman, was a very successful farmer. And he kept a minute record of his own spiritual life in diaries, as so many of the Puritans did. They were so in love with godliness because they were so in love with God. They weren't legalists, though sometimes in their writings they appear to be so. And indeed, Puritanism could easily become legalistic, and the very ethics of Puritanism could become tyrannous. There's no question about that. If you haven't got a Puritan heart, you can't live a Puritan life, and it's folly to expect a man to do so. But these men were intoxicated with the grace of God. And so their Puritanism was a sort of personal celebration of liberty from sin and liberty in godliness. Other people never understood that, you see. And when old Richard Rogers was riding one day on a country lane near Wethersfield, one of the gentry stopped him, a cocky young fellow, and leaned over his horse, and he said,
You know, Mr. Rogers, I like you well, only you are too precise. Ah, sir, the old man replied, I serve a precise God. And that was the Puritan's attitude. And there were others more well known in metropolitan areas, like young Henry Smith down at London, for instance. Now, Henry Smith was called the Silver-Tongued Smith. He was only 31 when he died. He only preached for 3 years in the metropolis, but he took it by storm. Crowds flocked to hear the young Puritan preacher, whose sermons are still extant, and they were published in the last century by the Nicholls series. You can get them from the Evangelical Library, and you'll see torrents of evangelical oratory poured out by this brilliant young preacher, who filled his church to capacity, and even the gentry who used to have to come, according to old Thomas Fuller, the quaint churchy 17th century historian, even the gentry had to bring their pews with them. That is, their legs. Henry Smith of London, whose sermons were printed, though he died so young, and were hugely popular and went through a legendary number of editions. Then, of course, there was William Perkins at Cambridge, a patriarchal figure of the Puritan movement. In his Cambridge ministry, a powerful preacher and a great theologian, preached and published much, but especially on cases of conscience. Something that you'll find right through the Puritan preachers. How to deal with spiritual depressions. How to deal with troubled souls. How to deal with people who just haven't got any assurance. How to deal with people who don't know if a situation is right or wrong for them. And they produced these great volumes. Well, Perkins was one of the first to do so. And he did it because the only people who'd been doing it up to then virtually were the Catholics. And he said, it's about time we had Puritan casuistry of the best sort, not the Catholic sort. And thereafter it became a typical feature of Puritanism that they preached on this subject of afflicted consciences and spiritual desertions and wrote voluminously on them. And you'll find a lot about it in my book, The Genius of Puritanism, which deals with the Puritans as pastors and counselors, as well as with the whole romance of the movement and its pulpit. Well, I've tried to fill out a little at this point to give you some idea of the people we're dealing with. Now, throughout Elizabeth's reign, some stayed and fought, some separated, and they became the separatists, determining to have reformation without tarrying for any. Some tried to fight the system from the top down, others tried to forward this revolution from the bottom up. And you can see the situation very clearly in such famous figures as Thomas Cartwright, who was one of the great, well, the great leader of the Presbyterian movement in Elizabeth's day. Theodore Beza, John Calvin's successor, said of him, "The sun doesn't shine on a more learned man." Now, he had a running battle with Archbishop John Whitgift, a great persecutor of the Christians and one of the most virulent opponents of Puritanism. Whitgift was Elizabeth's third archbishop. There was Matthew Parker I, who was a persecutor of the Puritans. There was Edmund Grindal, after he died, who was much in sympathy with them and a good man. And then there was John Whitgift, who was a furious opponent of the Puritans throughout Elizabeth's day and his life. And you have a very interesting example of Puritanism in action in the city, in the Temple Church at London, where you had two preachers. One of them, Richard Hooker, the great Anglican theologian, their great champion. He used to preach in the morning. But the other preacher in the afternoon was old Walter Travers. They weren't old, they were quite young men, actually, in their 30s. There was Walter Travers, who was a Puritan, totally the opposite, preaching in the afternoon. In fact, says Fuller, the pulpit spoke pure Canterbury in the morning and pure Geneva in the afternoon. Richard Hooker was undoubtedly the most brilliant from an academic point of view, but he wasn't such a great preacher. Travers, who was competent enough, was a brilliant preacher, and crowds flocked to hear him. And throughout this time you had frequent spates of persecution,
which involved fines and imprisonment of hundreds and even thousands of people and ministers throughout these many years of Elizabeth's reign. For instance, just in 1583, Whitgift fathered a spate of persecution when he tried to force three articles on everybody in the land in order to tighten up control. And there were in 1 year 60 ministers and more in Norfolk that lost their livings, suspended. There were 30 in Sussex, 20 in Kent, 26 in Essex, 60 in Suffolk. All ministers, all clergymen, all suspended for times long or short from their ministries. Many imprisoned and fined. And during the 45-year reign of Elizabeth, there were thousands suspended for various periods from their ministry. At one time, a third of her clergy were under some sort of discipline. There were crushing fines. There were short and long imprisonments. One of the men who suffered much was old John Udall. Udall, U-D-A-L. He wrote, and was well qualified to write, a commentary on the Lamentations of Jeremiah that you'll find mentioned in Spurgeon's Commenting and Commentaries somewhere. Old John Udall knew what it was to suffer imprisonment and despite and hurt, and said, "God's will be done. I had rather go to prison with a good conscience than be at liberty with a bad one." They wouldn't dress up in the robes. They wouldn't make the signs. They wouldn't go through the motions. They were evangelicals, and these things they considered to be contrary to their Puritanism and Protestantism. It was John Penry, for instance, who became a separatist and a martyr for the faith. Well, in 1603, after 45 years' reign, Elizabeth died, and Puritan hopes revived when James the First came to the throne. Now here I'm going to do an unusual thing. I don't know how long I've been, far too long. I knew I'd have this trouble, so I planned something. I'm going to split my lecture into two and have a hymn in between. Is that all right with you? Any objections? Carried in the best independent manner. The voice of the people. Right. Let's pause to sing and to worship. Let's sing the hymn number 719. The hymn number 719. We rest on thee, our shield and our defender. We go not forth alone against the foe. Strong in thy strength, safe in thy keeping tender, we rest on thee, and in thy name we go. A hymn that many of these imprisoned, harassed evangelical clergymen would have loved to have sung if anyone had written it in time. 719. We stand to sing, of course. Thank you.
3, 4, 5, 6 hours. So, don't feel too sorry for yourself. In 1603, after 45 years reigning, Elizabeth died. And the Puritan hopes rose very high because the new king would be James VI of Scotland. Scotland, as you know, was a Presbyterian country. James was a Presbyterian king. Not only that, but he had often said to his own Presbyterians that he despised the Anglicans of England and that he rejoiced to look forward to a day when he could properly Protestantize the place. But James was a liar and a knave, because James knew perfectly well that if a king wanted to retain full power of the land, he had to have power of the church as well as state. But they didn't know anything about this, and at the accession of James, and on his journey from Scotland to London, some Puritans, Arthur Hildesham and a few others, came with a great petition. It was called the Millenary Petition. It was called the Millenary Petition because over 1,000 Puritan ministers signed it, begging the king to take off from them some of the restraints, to take off some of the forced conformity that was harassing them.
James knew where the logical end of that would be, but he agreed to have a conference at Hampton Court in 1604, just in the following year. He made sympathetic noises there when there were representatives of the Puritans as well as the Anglican bishops, but little resulted from that conference except the great authorized version which was being translated from that time. But as for the Puritans, James now had a secure throne and he knew what to do with it. If this be all your party has to say, I will make them conform, or I will harry them out of the land, or else I will do worse. No king, no bishop, no king. He knew that the two powers went together. Archbishop Whitgift, who was still alive, shortly to die, said that he was verily persuaded that the king spoke by the Spirit of God. Well, Whitgift died a few months later, and Richard Bancroft, another persecutor of the Puritans, became Archbishop of Canterbury for 6 years. There followed throughout the reign of James I many suspensions and the harassing and imprisonments and fines of great and good Puritan ministers. Even parliamentarians weren't exempt. Nicholas Fuller, an MP and a barrister who had dared to defend the Puritans, was imprisoned for no less than 12 years until his death by the powers that were. Many were exiled abroad, including the famous Dr. William Ames, the great Puritan theologian of his day, who went to Holland with many others to Amsterdam and Rotterdam and Leiden. And then many went to Virginia, until it seemed that the flow was becoming embarrassing even for the prelates, because it seemed that they would start Puritan colonies over in the New World, over in what we call America. And so the Archbishop Richard Bancroft tried to stop that traffic. At this time, too, you have the separatists called the Puritan Fathers. They were separatists. And in 1620, you remember, they went to New England, eventually to develop and develop there their own full-blown Congregationalism, which was even a step removed from Presbyterianism. You see, these movements were in movement. Puritanism was developing all the time. It wasn't staying still. There were protests from Parliament. There were bills for various reforms, but they all came to nothing. But during this time, throughout James's reign, Puritanism was spreading. It was having a secret, silent victory of its own. 1,000 Puritan preachers and more in the country. What can come from them? A great deal came from them. More and more it spread, not only through the lower classes, but through the sons of the younger gentry, too, the lesser gentry, who were beginning to have more and more power. There was a whole middle class developing in England, and it was Puritanism that was having its way with those middle classes that were to prove so important in the next few years. There were great preachers at this time, of course, like John Rogers and Richard Sibbes and Robert Bolton of Kettering, Just to mention one, John Rogers, I talk about him in my book. Another plug. John Rogers of Dedham in Essex. He labored with famed success as one of the most forceful and awakening preachers of his age. I'm quoting, "His complete self-forgetfulness in the pulpit led him into occasional extremes of turbulent, tempestuous, and even desperate delivery. His packed congregations never forgot the occasion when he imitated the screams of souls in hell." But the solid substance of his sermons and the transparent earnestness of his matter rescued his preaching from the merely eccentric, and it provoked a contemporary Bishop Brownrigg to admit, "John Rogers will do more good with his wild notes than we with our set music." Another contemporary, a Puritan, Richard Steele, recalls that it was a saying among the godly at that time, "Let's go to Dedham to fetch fire." He was a great soul winner, great dramatist in the pulpit. But because my time is going on, I can't tell you one or two of the great anecdotes that I was going to tell you about him. So we come to the end of James's reign. James was a man astute but without principle, learned but without judgment, obsessed with the rights of kings but contemptuous of the rights of subjects. And he was succeeded by his son Charles I in 1625. Almost from the beginning, Puritan hopes were dashed, despite Puritans in high places like John Preston, who was a court chaplain and who had a great ministry in Cambridge and in London. I talked about him in one of the Westminster Conference papers that were published some time ago, and which are full of information about Puritanism, if you want to get any of them. Puritan hopes were dashed because from the beginning Charles I favored RCs, Roman Catholics, and married one, and despised nonconformity. During his time, the worst of all the archbishops came to power, William Laud, Bishop of Bath and Wells after Charles had come to power, then Bishop of London, then Archbishop of Canterbury, a great and furious persecutor of the Puritans, a high churchman obsessed with the idea of order and liturgy and beauty and all the other things that are so dear to the ultra Anglican heart, a high churchman and an Arminian who now began to persecute these preachers for their Calvinism in their doctrine as well as for their Protestantism in their manner of worship. Until then, you see, more or less everybody had been Calvinistic in England. The Anglicans as well as the Puritans were Calvinists. Even some of the bishops that had persecuted the Puritans, they were all Calvinists. And if you read the 39 articles, you'll see that it's basically predestinarian in its doctrine. I'm sorry, I'm being a bit careless. I shouldn't have said they were Calvinists in the sense of following John Calvin's church government. But what I mean, using the word popularly, is that they believed in things like election and final perseverance and the usual doctrines associated these days with Calvinism. But Laud was an Arminian and persecuted them for their doctrine as well as their practice. He raged against them using all the penalties of Star Chamber and prison. He reintroduced James's Book of Sports in an endeavor to destroy the Puritan Sunday and try to get them all to read it from their pulpits, with great penalties for any who refused to read the Book of Sports from their pulpits, and many suffered greatly for not doing it. One crafty Puritan, though, was more than a match for the occasion, and he read it and expounded it all the way through, preaching against it as he did so. Hundreds were harassed for their doctrine and for their practice, suspended, many more were exiled and imprisoned. Some of the tales hardly bear telling. One, which might be extreme, but there are many, many more which I could tell you, was of Alexander Leighton, a man who was the father of the famous Archbishop Leighton. That's another story. But Alexander Leighton had written a book against the bishops. And he, for his book, was condemned to be degraded from his ministry, to have his ears cut, his nose slit, to be branded in the face, to stand in the pillory, to be whipped at a post, and to pay £10,000 in fine. That would be something more like a couple of hundred thousand pounds by our money. When the sentence was passed, Lord pulled off his hat and, holding up his hands, gave thanks to God who had given him the victory over his enemies. That's Archbishop Lord for you. Poor old Alexander Leighton was kept in close imprisonment for over 10 years, till the civil wars and the Long Parliament, and when they fetched him out of his dungeon, the whole nation was horrified to learn the story of his fate. But it was all too like the fate of many, many others up and down the land. By the 1630s, so many had fled to the continent, thousands in fact. I remember one writer saying in a biography of John Bunyan, Gwilym O'Griffith, it's a wonderful opening sentence for any book, isn't it? He said, in the 1620s or 30s, whichever decade he was referring to, Lord's besom was busy sweeping the Puritans into the sea, and the sea was casting them up intact on the shores of New England. Sort of thing a historian loves to read, and even more to write. But so many were flying that in fact great efforts were made to stop them, and the people who were persecuting them out of the land then persecuted them to stop them going out of the land. So the poor Puritans were held in all sorts of ways. Still, Puritanism grew and spread, socially as well as geographically, throughout the country and beyond. Charles and Lord were a fatal combination, a king without a head and an archbishop without a heart. The one obsessed with royalty, the other obsessed with liturgy, and neither concerned with the rights or the consciences of men. But Puritanism, always a real and potent force, had grown at all levels in the country, with all sorts of ramifications, political as well as spiritual. It had established and fostered a sense of dignity. When a man knew his place before God, he discovered his place in society. He wasn't just a link in a chain. He was a person with personhood and rights. And if he had a position of significance before God, so had he before the king. He was a free man. Jesus Christ had made him free. And hence there was a growing rift in Parliament and in the country, in the church and in the state, between the old world mentality of kings and priests and the new world experience of individuals with a place before God and a place among men, with rights and privileges and vision. Much of Charles's reign had been spent without a parliament being called. Such was his despite of democracy. But by 1640, Charles was nearly bankrupt, virtually bankrupt. He'd gone into a war with Scotland, would you believe, trying to force episcopacy, Anglicanism, onto that Presbyterian country. It was a separate country then, you see, that hadn't been at the Act of Union. And there was this war going on. It had nearly bankrupted him. And having lost the trust and support of all his creditors and just about everybody else, he had to call a parliament. But the parliament that came, the Long Parliament, famous and honored, was largely composed of the very classes and people that had been most injured by the king's contempt and by the economic confusion of the times and by the religious fanaticism of Archbishop Laud and his fellow bishops in the realm. Now great events came in a crowd, treading on the heels of one another over the next 20 years. At first, the power of the king and his counselors were curtailed, and Laud was impeached and imprisoned. Soon, king and parliament were in a state of open war in the country, involving a large part of the nation. Kings and bishops had stood together. They were about to fall together. The upshot was, eventually, the victory of Parliament, the defeat of royalism and the king, the official abolition of episcopacy, the execution of Charles and Archbishop Laud, who was executed before. The reign, first of the Long Parliament, then of its rump, and then of smaller Puritan parliaments, then the reign of Oliver Cromwell on his own. And there followed 2 decades of turbulence, but of liberty. It was the time of the Puritan ascendancy, the most spiritually glorious time in this period. the Puritan ascendancy. You see, I've tried to show you all along in my lecture that the Puritans had as much right as the Anglicans to say, this is the way we should go. This is the way the churches in England should go. Everything had been in an inchoate state when it had all started, but they'd never had a chance to pull their weight. And after 100 years of hopes and disappointments, of brave struggles and countless privations, of growing prestige and gathering prayer, the spiritual grandchildren of those refugees from Mary Tudor at last found before them an open door, a church scene in England that could be reformed, that could be evangelicalized, could be reformed by spiritual means. Of course, by no means all of the Commonwealth Puritans, to use the word Commonwealth of this period, were content to restrict themselves to purely spiritual means of change. The Puritans differed among themselves at this time. Remember, these movements keep developing. Puritanism had developed. There were the Presbyterians of the old type, but there were now the Independents that we are most familiar with, of the new type. And eventually, of course, in this period, the Baptists emerged and all the others. But the Presbyterians still had the old church-state idea, and if they had had their way, they would have been as rigorous in enforcing their own sort of uniformity as the Anglicans had been in their day. But they were stopped by the Independents, by Oliver Cromwell, by elements in the army. That's another story again. Still, all over the land, the lights of spiritual, unhindered ministries burned bright. From Puritan ministers in the north, like old Oliver Heywood and Richard Gilpin, to the host of celebrated Puritan pulpits in London, like those of William Googe of Blackfriars, who spent 33 years preaching on the Book of Hebrews. And to a packed church, I may say. They used to say you hadn't visited London until you'd been to Blackfriars and heard him preach on Hebrews. It was Joseph Carrill who spent over 25 years preaching on the Book of Job in his midweek lecture. There was Thomas Brooks, and Carrill had a great congregation too. There was Thomas Brooks, one of the raciest of the old Puritan preachers. His works were published by the Banner of Truth recently in 6 volumes, full of illustrations and vivid, pungent sayings. There was Thomas Watson, whose works were published recently on the Ten Commandments and the Lord's Prayer, you remember. Typical things for the Puritans to preach on in series. There was Thomas Vincent, shaggy, hellfire and brimstone Thomas Vincent, with his huge audience, very successful among the lower orders, if I can use the phrase. There was Thomas Manton, whom everybody knows, and so on and so on. At the once royalist Oxford University, Cambridge had often been a nest of Puritans in one college or another, but Oxford was very royalist. There was the splendid partnership of John Owen and Thomas Goodwin. Thomas Goodwin of Magdalen, the president, and John Owen, vice-chancellor of the university as a whole, which boldly reversed the tendencies of years and made Oxford, for a while, the seat of Puritan learning and influence among the student world. The press turned out books by the thousand, large and small, on every conceivable aspect of the Puritan life. From folios to pamphlets, doctrinal matters, great and small, were agitated and expounded. It was the Augustan age of evangelical literature and evangelical preaching, a halcyon time for all its problems of freedom and inquiry. Those 20 years. However, it was not to last indefinitely. By 1660, Oliver was dead. The Puritan movement was divided, the ruling classes even more so, and their leaders, even and especially the Presbyterian politicians and leaders, as well as the Anglicans, had turned once again from the confusion of the time to the old security of King, Lords, and Commons. Charles II, the son of Charles I, who'd been executed, was recalled from France, and he resumed the monarchy in England, and the Puritan experiment was swiftly and ruthlessly dismantled by the new rulers, the bishops and the parliamentarian royalists. Parliament, you see, was now largely royalist in the lower House of Commons and strongly anti-Puritan in the upper House of Lords where the bishops reigned. And it ensured no protection for the moving spirits of the Puritan Commonwealth. And soon the storm clouds were looming over the thousands of Puritan pulpits in the land, which so largely embodied the Commonwealth spirit. Prelacy, episcopacy, the rule of the bishops was restored and enforced. The prayer book was re-established at the center of all church worship, with even more anti-Puritan and unevangelical features than before. And by one of the most famous dates in history, I know you're tired, hold on, by August the 24th, 1662, St. Bartholomew's Day, Black Bartholomew, as the Puritans called it for generations after that, all the clergy of the land had to agree to a new act of uniformity, more vicious in principle and practice than ever Elizabeth's had been. They had to agree, among other things, to three impositions. First, reordination for those ministers that hadn't been ordained by bishops, that hadn't been episcopally ordained. No, this is very important. That alone would have been enough to have stopped the Puritans conforming, and they knew it. And indeed, this was a treacherous thing, because even the Anglican Communion had always recognized the ordination of other denominations, if you like. People from the continent who came over were regarded as properly ordained when they came into the C of E. Even Roman Catholics didn't have to be reordained. But Puritans who'd been ordained by Puritans, by Presbyterians and Independents, they had to be reordained. The Puritans would never have considered it. It would have meant accepting that their ministers had been invalid. And they were regarded by these high churchmen as sacramentally invalid. What that did to the marriages and the baptisms, I don't know. Reordination was the first imposition. The second, unfeigned assent and consent to all and everything within the new book of common prayer. And assent and consent aren't the same things, you know. They mean positive agreement as well as submission. Assent as well as consent to all and everything within the new book of common prayer, with its readings from the Apocrypha. They'd introduced some of the most lurid and ridiculous parts of the Apocrypha into it, knowing that the Puritans couldn't stomach it. With all the injunctions to kneel to receive the sacrament at the rails, to make the sign of the cross in baptism, to pronounce the burial service in sure and certain hope of the resurrection and to life eternal, and so on. Again, there was no way in which the Puritans could subscribe to such a thing. To swear on oath that they accepted as consonant with the word of God everything in that prayer book, which one of the Puritans described in a great sentence as defective in necessaries, redundant in superfluities, dangerous in some things, disputable in many, disorderly in all. Thomas Sharp of Addle in Yorkshire. And lastly, they had to agree to the admission to the sacraments of all persons whose life was not openly scandalous and who was baptized into the English Church, the Church of England. The destruction of the visible saint ideal. Well, men had sometimes been able to hedge and get around the old conformity of Elizabeth's day and James's day and Charles's day, but there was no getting around the new conformity of 1662 and the days of Charles II. It was sign or lose everything. And the result? 1/5 of the entire clergy of the church in England refused to conform and lost their livings overnight. 2,000 and more men were cast out of their benefices and their lectureships, out into the world with no benefit of welfare state. Cast into poverty and despite, into cruelty and persecution. 2,000 and more, including what Bishop Ryle of the last century, the evangelical bishop of Liverpool, called the best, the ablest, and the holiest ministers of the day. 60 of the leading parishes in London were at once deprived of their ministers. That's in London alone. And their congregations were left like sheep without a shepherd. What was true in London was true in hundreds of parishes throughout the length and breadth of the land. Ryle says of the Act and the new prayer book, it was notoriously framed so as to be offensive to the consciences of the Puritans and to drive them out of the church. Taking all things into consideration, he says, and this is an Anglican bishop, a more impolitic and disgraceful deed never disfigured the annals of a Protestant church. They made it a matter of congratulation among themselves that they had thrust out the Puritans and got in Bell and the Dragon. One of the apocryphal stories from the Apocrypha. Well, my time is gone and overgone, and you've been marvelous for being so patient. The story of the ejected 2,000 is one of the great epic dramas of courage and faith. They were refugees cast out into a cruel world with no other expertise or visible means of support, cast out of their houses, their vicarages, their parsonages. Said one of them, old Mr. Lawrence of Bass Church, whom nobody would ever have remembered if he hadn't said this, I have 11 arguments for conformity, pointing to his wife and 10 children. But Christ hath said, whoso loveth wife or children more than me is not worthy of me. The more fortunate who became everything from shopkeepers to doctors. But many nearly starved and were a pitiable sight for years and years in the country. Doctors of divinity were found, keeping sheep. Learned and pious pastors, men of culture and education, most of them, you see, had been educated in Oxford and Cambridge. Men of learned and pious lives were forced to become hired farm hands because they had no other skill, any more perhaps than your minister and myself would. Can't speak for him, but I can speak for me. So they were cast out to do what they could to keep their families. Many preached occasionally as they could to a few here and a few there, but vilely were they persecuted for it. And if you read C.R. Cragg's book, Puritanism and in a Time of Persecution, you'll find a splendid but harrowing chapter on the sufferings of the ejected Puritans at this time, on their stinking prisons, the overcrowded dungeons, the terrible privations of families, the starving bairns and babes. It's a terrible story. Richard Baxter put his own feelings into words in verse. Dear old Richard Baxter, who could persecute the Catholic-spirited Richard Baxter, the most moderate of men? These bishops weren't moderate. These Anglicans weren't moderate. Believe me, they were extreme. Baxter, that most ecumenical of spirits, if I can use the word, put it like this: must I be driven from my books, from house and goods and dearest friends? One of thy sweet gracious looks for more than this will make amends. My Lord hath taught me how to want a place wherein to lay my head. While he is mine, I'll be content to beg or lack my daily bread. For the next 20 years, at various times and in various places, the Puritan 2,000 and the people that gathered around them were the pawns of politics, the butt of ridicule, and the prey of worthless informers and bigoted local magistrates. Baxter, years after, recalls of the sufferings of the expelled clergy. Many hundreds of them, with their wives and children, had neither house nor bread. Their congregations had enough to do, besides a small maintenance, to help them out of prisons or to maintain them in them. Early on in this long and wicked period, in 1664, there was the Conventicle Act, which made it illegal to gather 5 or more persons over 16 years for religious instruction outside of the established church, with fines and threatened transportation for persistent offenders. There was the cruel ingenuity in 1665 of the 5 Mile Act, which forbade any of the ejected clergymen to come within 5 miles of any corporate town under penalty of heavy fines. They were treated as lepers. More than that, these ministers could at least rely on their friends in the towns and their old parishioners and some of their old friends, but now they were exiled, so that even then their families were split up. The ministers had to go. They didn't dare take their wives and children, because at least there was the charity of their old congregations abroad. But they themselves had to leave their wives and children for years sometimes. You see how inhuman, how cruel it all was. And we must not forget, too, the thousands of people who were not clergy, who were fined and imprisoned and beaten for their nonconformity and attendance at the meetings and their use of their homes. I'm on my last page. However, we all know the story of underground churches. Over the period of persecution, 1662 to 1688, over the period of persecution, large numbers of secret conventicles rose and began to flourish. And in 1672, when there was a little period of official respite, no less than 3,500 meeting places were licensed for Presbyterian or independent worship. And over 1,300, to be precise, 1,339 preachers were recorded, besides other occasional preachers. By 1688, great changes had taken place. 26 years of persecution and underground development, 26 years of changing politics, inexorably crushing the old attitude, anti-democratic and kingly. By 1688, great changes had taken place. Charles II had died, and his brother James, Duke of York, had come to the throne. He was a Catholic and a thoroughgoing despot. The composition of Parliament had begun to change significantly. There had always been nonconformists, even after 1662 in Parliament. We don't hear much about them, but it's quite a story. But the composition of Parliament had been changing. The old Toryism was giving way to the new liberal Whig political animal. James's despotism and Catholicism threatened a return to the dark days of Mary Tudor, and James was overthrown in the bloodless revolution of 1688, and William of Orange took his place on the English throne, a Protestant king within a more firm and advanced parliamentary democracy. A bill of toleration was passed, which once and for all restored the ancient liberties of the surviving nonconformists and their heirs. The underground river had emerged, the Protestant evangelicalism of the free churches. That river was to grow and deepen throughout the 18th century and into the 19th, beginning with William Carey and the modern missionary movements. It was to flow to the uttermost parts of the earth, irrigating the wastelands of the world with the gospel of Paul and John and Peter, the gospel of Luther and Calvin and the Puritans.